KFMB presents It's Your Money, Not Theirs with your hosts Richard Musio and Joe Vecchio. Now, here are Richard and Joe.
All right, good evening and welcome to the Academy Award edition of It's Your Money, Not Theirs. I'm Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, and hope you had a great week. And time now to introduce the man of the hour, CPA and family office advisor to many high net worth families, the illustrious Richard Musio. Richard, good evening. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Joe. Thank you. Next year, it's going to be you and me winning an Academy Award.
You think so?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll take radio into the visual sphere.
Yeah. Well, anyway, in case anybody's wondering, Joe and I are working on a movie concept, and someday we're going to be famous.
Well, we're getting there.
We're getting there.
I just wanted to, a little footnote to last week's show with Dr. Victor DeNoble. I did mention that my father was able to quit smoking after 50 years, and he was diagnosed. But I did not say that the last 5 years were he passed away from smoking. So I don't think I made that point. I hate to start out on a bummer of a note, but, you know, if you listened to last week's show, and I hope you listen to it again, there's nothing. I don't think there's anything good that results from smoking after a lifetime. But anyway, Richard, we have a great show tonight with a very special guest, and I'm going to let you get into that right now.
We have with us Mr. Andy Blocker from UBS. UBS, of course, is our major sponsor on this radio show, so We thank Drew Freitas and the team for doing that. But Andy Blocker is in town over the weekend, did some events for UBS late last week, and I guess is around until about Tuesday.
In town from where, Richard?
Well, I'm not quite sure where he flew from, because he told me he was, you know, Florida, Utah. He's back east. But
he's based in Washington,
He's
D.C.
based in Washington. But he is the managing director and federal affairs manager for UBS. So this is a show about policy, or policy in Washington, not just income tax policy, but all kinds of issues surrounding policy. So we're very excited to have Andy here. Andy, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I understand you don't do much media, Andy. Is that correct?
I try not to make it a habit.
So we're very honored to have you here today to issue your opinions. And from Washington, right? Based in Washington, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's sort of a funny tie-in to last week's show, because Dr. Vincent DeNoble testified before the Waxman Committee in 1994. And Andy, you at that time were in the Clinton White House.
Not quite yet. I was
not quite yet. You were on the
Senate Budget Committee.
Senate Budget Committee. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you don't look that old.
Thank you.
Well, you've been in D.C. like, what, 20 years or so?
Yes, 20 years.
Oh, my gosh. He doesn't have any wrinkles yet. It's amazing.
So who in this room watched the Republican debate on Wednesday night?
I caught bits and pieces, but
yeah, I did too.
I can only take so much of political debate. Yeah,
I thought Obama won that debate. But let's start with some income tax policy, because I noticed that.
Well, Richard, can we get into Andy's background?
Yeah, go ahead.
Because this guy has got such an impressive.
It's quite the resume.
I mean, Harvard degree in economics, undergrad. He got his business degree at Georgetown, and born and raised in the East Coast, right, Andy?
Mm-hmm.
New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then take us what happened to you after Harvard in business school.
So essentially I worked on Capitol Hill. First job was actually in corporate America. And I was a low man on a totem pole at a Fortune 500 company. That didn't work out too well.
Okay.
So
are you allowed to say which company or not?
Sure. Bell Atlantic, which is now Verizon.
Okay.
So I found myself looking for work, and a friend of mine from college, from Harvard.
What year was this?
This is 1991.
Okay.
And a friend of mine said, you should look on Capitol Hill. And I said, they don't pay anything. He says, well, they're paying you more than you're making now. So I said, you got a good point. So I'd always been interested in politics, so I went up to the Hill and started looking for a job. And in a couple of weeks, I actually had a job answering phones for a congressman from Texas,
and that was,
then started doing legislative work at a very early age. It's great.
Martin Frost, Democrat from Texas, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And then what happened?
Then after there for a couple years, I got a job on the Senate Budget Committee, and using some of my economics and some of the experience I gained in the House, and was there for a couple budget cycles, and next thing you know, I get a call from the White House to go work for them. I was like, okay, I'll look at what you try to offer me.
This is the Clinton White House.
Clinton White House, yeah.
So at the Senate Budget Committee, who did you work? Did you work directly for the chair?
Chairman was Senator Sasser from Tennessee.
Okay.
And then after one election cycle, Senator Exum took over and from Nebraska.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So then you get into the White House and do what?
So after I figured out that this was a good job opportunity, I started.
Well, that always looks good on the resume.
Yeah, it looks great on the resume. Now, remember when I was interviewing, he had just lost the midterm elections. And,
okay.
You know, so everyone wasn't excited about Clinton at the time. But I said, you know, let's buy low and hold on the way up. So we went in and was a special assistant to the president for legislative affairs, which easily translated is I was one of the president's lobbyists. Wow. They don't call it that, but that's essentially what you do. You're there to advance his legislative agenda with members of Congress.
And he got that Deficit Reduction Act in, was that when you were there?
Or? Yes, in 97.
With not one Republican vote, I'll have.
Yeah, that's right. There was not one single Republican vote on the 97 deficit.
At least in the
Senate.
In the Senate.
Really?
I thought it was a bipartisan.
I thought Gore was like the tie. Well, it was a 50-50, and then Gore had to cast a tie-breaking vote. But
yeah, but there was some. It ended up being bipartisan in the end.
Well, I hope so.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. So right. You know, it gets contentious, but you work things out.
Okay. Well, that's the way it goes in politics.
So deficit reduction is obviously a huge policy issue. And I know the president released his fiscal year budget proposal.
Mm-hmm.
Very early, about a week ago.
Yes.
And I was reading through that, and it's very interesting. Without going into specifics, I think one of the challenges is going to be either Obama will be newly elected to a second term, or he's going to be a lame duck president as we hit the end of the year. And so unlike 4 years ago when he was, I think, maybe somewhat conciliatory on income tax policy, I don't know that he is motivated to be so inclined this time around, because in either case, I think he carries a little bit more power, because he can't get reelected to a third term, and if he's not reelected, he's gone in a month or two. What do you think about that?
I think you're absolutely right. I think the president's posture is pretty certain right now that he is not going to extend the income tax rates for the top two brackets. That's not negotiable. I think the most you can see happening is if he's reelected in the lame duck session between the election and January 1, there's a good possibility that he will strike a deal with members of Congress to extend the current tax rates through the first 6 to 9 months of the following year, so they have time to actually do real substantive, thoughtful changes.
Mm-hmm. But isn't he now suggesting to lower the corporate tax from 35% to 28% as well?
He's also proposed that. Mm-hmm. The details aren't all in there, but no, that's going to be part of the debate too. I think from my perspective, there's not much going to happen between now and the end of the year. Most people know that. But I think the first 6 to 9 months of next year, there's an opportunity for a lot of things to get done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think this is the year that you prepare for that. You've seen the tax committees, the Joint Tax Committee, do a lot of work on what different proposals are. You've seen a lot of proposals out there. I think anything that's not talked about this year will be behind the curve next year.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've talked through this year, it'll be right after the election. There'll be a willingness of both sides to work together. And I think a lot can happen.
All right. Well, we'll come right back with more interesting information about all this stuff going on in Washington with more of Music Bonanza for those you old enough to remember. But we're back with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs. And now over to Richard and our guest, Andy.
So Andy, let me ask a question. I don't want to beat technical income tax stuff to death, but just to give some of our listeners some of the things that might happen if the Bush-era tax cuts aren't extended. The top marginal tax rate right now on individuals at 35%, scheduled to go back to 39.6%. Our present 15% tax rates on qualified dividends and long-term capital gains, scheduled to rise in the case of capital gains up to 20%. And so here's my big picture question, because with regard to economic policy and attempting to further stimulate the economy, obviously if we don't extend the Bush-era tax cuts, at least temporarily, say for the next congressional cycle, call that 1 year, there's going to be a huge drag on the economy. because these tax cuts are significant, you know, as a function of the percentage of the, you know, the baseline, you know, capital gains rates. That's a 33% increase on long-term capital gains, for example, in terms of the amount of tax somebody would pay. So what are your thoughts about how important the possible extension of the Bush-era tax cuts is or are to what's going on here in the economy?
I think that's a great question, Richard. I think, look, I think right now, as far as the economy is concerned, I think the number one thing people want is some certainty. The problem is I can't give you that today. I mean, the current political climate does not allow for much to happen between now and the end of the year. But I do think, at least on the capital gains, I think there's agreement between the parties that it shouldn't be at a higher level than 20% at least. So at least the baseline you're going off, you can only go get so bad. And the problem is when you start talking about dividends, interest, that there's a big disparity there, and it's going to have to be worked out in the negotiations when they actually start talking about the tax policy.
You know, the Federal Reserve, they keep driving the interest rate lower and lower. I heard Meredith Whitney on CNBC yesterday saying that she thinks it should probably go up a little bit because obviously that affects, you know, investment funds and things of that nature, especially retirees and whatnot. But what do you think? I think the Fed, they were trying to drive the housing market or fuel it or with reducing interest rates, and it's just not happening right now. What else can we do? Can we force reduced principal? Can we think about relieving debt relief of some sort or liability relief like what you did with American Airlines? Or what works?
Well, that's if we solve that, we solve the problem. I mean, the big barrier to growth in this country's economy right now has been the housing market. Mm-hmm. And you have tons of foreclosures, excess houses on the market, you know, new starts are you know, right. They're not the level you would normally see in a recovery. I think
because home values obviously were inflated, there's a bubble. So now, how do you deflate that bubble in a nice way so everyone to help find a floor or a foundation to get confidence back in the housing market, and then hopefully things will jump from there.
The problem is that there's no quick solution to this. Mm-hmm. We didn't get here overnight. We're not getting out of it mm-hmm. overnight. When I'm trying to be encouraging, I say 5 years from now. Mm-hmm. When I try to be a little more realistic, I say 10 mm-hmm. plus.
So what do you think would or should happen to the housing market when you say it's a correction?
Yeah, I think part of it, you just have to let the market run its course. You have to mm-hmm. let the foreclosures go through the system. Some banks are moving foreclosures faster than others. Some aren't. So, but from a policy perspective, I think the key thing they're talking about right now is the GSE debate, government-sponsored enterprises, mm-hmm. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And the interesting thing to me is that before the election, you heard the Republicans talking about, well, we're going to privatize them and we're going to get rid of them. But you've noticed that that hasn't really happened.
Mm-mm.
And that's partly because the policy reality is that the job they're doing right now, that's very needed to uphold the market. And all the mortgage-backed securities, all that foreign countries are investing in, they're only going to invest in if there is a 100% guarantee, which the federal government is backed right now. If you get rid of that backing, all that investment goes away. If that investment goes away, you think the housing market's mm-hmm. bad now, it gets really bad. So these are tough decisions. Now, if you want to privatize down the road, maybe you bifurcate the market. You keep what's on the books guaranteed and start a new market. But even in that new market, as soon as the economy goes down, you're not going to see 30-year mortgages issued unless there's some kind of federal government backing. And so that's the dilemma. You have a philosophical thought of, okay, we'd like to see this, but then there's the practical reality of the way the housing market works.
Hmm.
So let's get back to your comment mm-hmm. on uncertainty, because sure. Earlier this week I was at an estate planning update where I think probably the most uncertain laws, not income tax, estate tax. We have a $5 million death and gift exemption here in 2012 that's set to sunset back down to $1
million. $5.12 million.
Well, yeah, index for
inflation.
Don't
forget that.
Yeah. 120,000 index for inflation. You don't get to be worth $5 million at least without worrying about $120,000 here and there. But this is extremely uncertain because President Obama in his Green Book was pretty clear that he wants to reduce that to $3.5 million mm-hmm. and raise the rate of 35% to 45%. Obviously, if nothing happens and it sunsets, it's $1 million with a marginal tax rate of 55%. And then there's many Republicans who say we should just scrap the estate tax altogether because at a $5 million exemption, it's only projected that 3,300 taxpayers have to file tax returns, you know, who died, for example, in 2011 or projected in 2012. And that begs the question, why have an administration system for only 3,300 taxpayers? But the uncertainty is causing, and I know there's not necessarily sympathy for high net worth families because they're already high net worth. But these people can't even make a decision about whether they should do gifting, not do gifting. And let's assume you're worth $10 million exactly. You don't even know if you have no estate tax or you're going to owe $3.5 million of estate tax. You're going to owe $1.3 million of estate tax. And how the heck do you do any planning whatsoever? And so to me, the uncertainty is by far and away the most unsettling thing, whether it's surrounding income tax, estate tax. Businesses, high net worth families, people who own companies, they can't really make decisions because they just don't know. And I know... I guess, in my opinion, the biggest challenge is there's a real different philosophy on what the role of government should be in all of this. Mm-hmm. Can you comment on how that different philosophy of what the role of government should be is, in my opinion, causing gridlock?
Sure. I think that, you know, basically President Obama's budget has always said, has split the difference almost between current law
right.
at January 1, which is $1 million exception, 55%, and the 35%, $5 million. It's kind of pretty much in the middle. And I think the thing that he's dealing with politically is that the left of his party is rabid on this issue. They believe that they should be able to tax every dime mm-hmm. that you're of your state. And so, and then you have the other side where people think none of it should be. So I think at the end of the day, you're gonna come up with something very close, something I think between where President Obama's budget is and where it is today. But that only happens in the context of a large tax deal. Mm-hmm. He's shown the willingness to compromise as he did when they extended the Bush tax cuts. He did it a lot higher than most people thought at the mm-hmm, time, and right. I think that opportunity is going
to
come back.
All right, well, hold that thought, Andy, because we have to take a break right now. We'll be right back after news, sports, and weather with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs. Stay tuned. All right, we're back with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs, with our very special guest from Washington, D.C., Andy Blocker of the UBS office. And now over to Richard to thank some sponsors.
Well, again, thanks to our major sponsor, UBS, and also our other sponsors, Rich Gaines and Family Legacy Legal, the CPA firm of Plato Epic, that's Don Epic, CPA, and Paul Polito, CPA, and Carl Sheeler with Business Valuations Limited. Carl, of all the protagonists that I just mentioned, probably has the most at risk if the estate tax goes away, because that's all he does is value fractional interest, where we take discounts to help wealthy families avoid and reduce the estate tax. But I don't want to stay on income tax policy too much longer because we're halfway through the show and we have a lot of policy issues to talk about. But just one more question, because it's a real hot topic right now in the news, Andy. This concept of carried interest that Mitt Romney has brought to the forefront, mm-hmm. where hedge funds and private equity managers on the back end of deals, when they earn their what we call sponsor or contributory profits, taxed as capital gains. I noticed in the president's budget proposal, he seeks to eliminate this. In other words, to tax all of these profits as ordinary income. In fact, ordinary income subject to self-employment tax. And reading between the lines, it seems like he's pretty adamant on that particular stance. And this might be a bargaining chip with some of the other trade-offs he might be willing to make with the Bush-era tax cuts. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I just think it's in line with his philosophy, I think, with the Buffett rule and making sure that the higher income payers pay at least as much, if not more, percentage of their income, whether you call it income or not, as those who don't make as much.
And is that loophole only for private equity companies and hedge funds, or is that for other entities as well?
Joe, I don't want to get bogged down in that in this show because it's fairly technical, but it's for any fund or equity fund where you have a sponsor or a promoter who isn't the capital partner. So you're doing a joint venture where somebody puts a ton of money in, let's say a passive investor like a family office or a pension fund. And then you have this entrepreneurial business serenity that grows that value through, you know, their particular expertise in the cable world or the energy world or the real estate world. And on the back end, they get a split of the profits after the capital partner has gotten a certain what we call preferred return or guaranteed return. And it's much like how Mitt Romney built his wealth through Bain Capital. They would go in and turn companies around, but he wasn't making money up front.
I see.
But when certain, shall we say, targets were hit,
mm-hmm.
and investors had gotten their promised returns, then everybody would share the profits on a 60-40 split or 80-20, whatever the case may be. And it's been highly debated because in many cases ordinary income is being generated because you might have a trade or business that's generating income, and then on the back end somebody has a big old capital gain, and people say, well, that's not really fair because, you know, it's only a 15% tax rate and the investors had to pay ordinary income tax rates because their preferred return was probably ordinary, etc. And so it's a real fairness issue in the minds of a lot of folks. And it's always been sort of a nice little secret of the wealthy families, you know, who like to structure deals this way. But Mitt Romney certainly brought it out in public, and I just noticed it was prominently displayed in the president's budget proposal. One last thing about his tax proposal, which I found interesting, and then we'll move on to other policy issues. There's a prohibition in there against outsourcing to foreign countries. There's language that suggests that any deductions or any payments made to outsourcing companies will not be deductible for income tax purposes. Did you notice that in the bill, Andy, or have you?
No, it's the first I've heard of it, but it would be in line with the philosophy that they're moving on. I mean, they've even done some events on insourcing, which most people don't talk that way, but you know, for those companies like ours that has a global company with a foreign headquarters, I mean, we're actually creating jobs here,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Versus moving them overseas. So that's part of the philosophy of the administration.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. But let's get off of tax policy. Sure. Who in this room loves Dodd-Frank? Nobody raised their hand.
Actually, it's interesting. The only legislative accomplishment of the president in his first 2 years that was popular at the time of the midterm elections was Dodd-Frank.
Right.
Over 61% at the time said that they wanted it. The interesting thing is that today, the polling says 83% of Americans believe that Wall Street should be subject to tougher regulation even post Dodd-Frank being passed.
So my question is that based on fact, or is that just a general feeling that Wall Street consists of rich people and rich people don't pay enough tax, and so therefore they should have more regulation? And
it's actually a combination. I think, you know, look, I worked at the New York Stock Exchange for 7 years, and during that time period, you saw a lot of people bashing Wall Street, but the American public didn't get behind that movement because people were crying about all the bonuses people were making. It wasn't until 2008 and the financial crisis and when banks took federal money that the worm turned. Because once you take, first of all, they were blamed for the crisis, which everyone's suffering from, number one. Number two, the fact that the American taxpayer had to bail you out.
Well, what is your opinion of TARP? I mean, you hear various opinions. Mm-hmm. I mean, some said not all the banks needed the money, but I guess Paulson held the gun to their heads and made them all take it. And
it's on the record. It's that's exactly what happened. I think the facts are that TARP, all the money that the major banks took has been paid back, and the American people have made money.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not, I'm in the policy world, but I'm also in the political world. And the political world, it's not about facts all the time. It's about how people feel.
Right. Public opinion.
And it's not, there may be just one small part of it that's true, but most of the money that's still owed was given to GM, AIG, those outside that world. So it's some of it's misplaced, but some of it's deserved. I mean, I think,
You can make a good argument for the auto industry that bailout money worked well there.
It worked great. I mean,
look what it's done in Detroit in terms of turning.
Mm-hmm.
And that city, that state around.
Of course, a lot of those cars are getting bought in Asia.
China's doing great with that.
Yeah, no kidding. But getting back to Dr. Frank, a lot of people on the street don't know this, but there's increased capital requirements are being phased in over 6 years. I think it's called Basel III or Basel III? Mm-hmm.
Basel III.
Basel III. Can you tell us about that, Andy?
Yeah, so that is basically saying you have higher capital requirements across the board, and the types of capital that you hold, it must be more certain, must be more liquid than it has been in the past, and more guaranteed. Because a lot of the things that they could say was capital could seize up in a bad market, and you really couldn't access it. It wasn't really real. So they're doing those two things. It's interesting. The Basel requirements, they're phased in over a long period of time, partly because in a down economy like we have now, you need banks to be able to lend. But if they're having to put all their capital in to fulfill the capital requirements, they can't lend it. So that's the interesting thing about where we are. We want to put more of a safety and soundness umbrella over the banks, but at the same time, we want them to make loans to get the economy spurring. So it's really a catch-22 right now. But those will be in place, and countries around the world are putting in their own, including the U.S., their own requirements, and they're tougher. The U.S.'s is not as tough. But Switzerland's more tough.
Well, that's the rap you hear now, that not enough lending is happening, and corporations are sitting on tons of cash on their balance sheets, right? And what do we do to stimulate that? I guess that's...
Well, again, Joe, I think that gets back to the uncertainty. Businesses are sitting on tons of cash because they're not certain what the income tax rules are going to be. You might say, well, why not spend the cash and go out and hire a bunch of new employees? Well, you know, that's got to pencil out in terms of being a profitable decision, and nobody...
I'm just trying to stimulate research, development, business, innovation here.
Right, but until we know what income tax rules are and estate tax rules are beyond, the next 9 or 10 months, I just don't see people pulling the trigger to make any major decisions. Speaking generally, obviously some people are making major decisions economically, companies are, but in general they aren't, because I think the uncertainty has... People say the gridlock is because of the Republicans and Democrats not getting on or getting along together. I think it's because of the grotesque uncertainty in the estate and income tax codes. The people with money and businesses with money can't operate in an environment where we don't know what the rules are even next January. Just my opinion. So that's why this election is going to be so fascinating.
Yeah,
because that's going to start the process to getting to some sort of conclusion.
All right. Well, we're ready for another break, so we'll be right back with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs after these short announcements.
About policy surrounding money and income taxes, and we only have about 8 or 9 minutes to go. So let's talk about some other policy issues, just so that we can cover all the topics that the Republican debaters are covering, because they never seem to want to talk about money. I don't know. Where do you want to start? How about immigration? To me, that's an election issue. That's not really... Well, immigration. I mean, certainly the Republican candidates have been talking about it a lot. And do you really think the voters care, Andy? I mean, because the people I talk to on the street, they're worried about not having enough money. They're not worried about immigration.
I think they do care, but I think they first care about what you just said. I mean, consistently the polling is economy and the jobs. It's what I call financial security. If you don't have that, there are two things, I think. If you don't have financial security, or what I call physical security, whether it's national defense, fighting crime, fighting terrorism, if you don't take care of those two things, it doesn't matter what else you do. It's kind of like your psychology course. We learned about Maslow's order of needs. If you don't take care of the basic essentials, it doesn't matter. But if you take care of the essentials, then we can start talking about immigration. We can talk about other things. Even though, actually, I think immigration is a economic issue, if you really look at it.
It kind of relates to free trade and NAFTA. Now, what's your take on free trade? You hear arguments both ways. Was it a good thing? I mean, if we had not passed that, would we have retained more jobs here? But profitability would have gone down. I mean, you've got this global labor force. You've got global markets. Everything's global now. And I guess we have to try to create more global businesses here if we're going to compete. I mean, and in education, what you mentioned, you were going to mention, or are going to mention, we're competing globally on an education basis now as well.
Well, related to them, I mean, Obama is certainly going to promote or try to further advance the DREAM Act without question.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think the challenge with immigration is there's never been a firm policy that's lasted very long. And so that's why it's such a passionate issue.
Do you think building a 70-foot wall for 22,000 miles is a good idea? I don't, but...
Yeah, well, I don't know that education is going to be a priority either. I mean, I'm curious as to what your thoughts are, Andy. But again, when people don't have money, I know schools have no money either, but that's because people have no money.
Because governments have no money.
Right. So I think it's the same answer, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think education's is critical to the future of this country. I mean, everyone, if you talk to anyone, any economist, any person who really thinks about this, if you talk to corporate leaders, I mean, they want a skilled workforce going forward. And that's why I think the president's policy that he announced about community colleges is so important. Now, there's not the money right now for that. It's nothing's going to happen this year. But as we move into the debate next year, and you do a comprehensive tax reform / deficit reduction package, there are going to have to be some investments in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the first place those investments need to take place are education and infrastructure.
And, of course, everyone looks to the federal government to help in education, which is such a local issue, except, I guess, when you get in the higher levels. But, you know, in California, we spend over $6 billion on our prison system and corrections, and only $4 billion on our CSU and UC system. Our priorities, I don't think are in order. And maybe we need to rethink the whole prison industry from a business standpoint. And I don't know if that should be privatized. I'm not so sure that's a good idea. But
yeah, I don't know. But I've got one more topic because I know we're running out of time here. But this topic of energy security, to me, is very, very important. And it's also controversial. And I'm surprised there hasn't been much more talk about it during the Republican debates, because it really hasn't been addressed. Andy, what are your thoughts on energy security?
Well, if you talk to the military, the first thing they'll tell you is that energy is the national security issue.
Even for them, they're doing a lot of mm-hmm. green projects themselves.
Right.
So moving towards an economy that's less reliant on Middle East oil is an imperative. I think there is a weakness that the president has politically on this. He's satisfied the environmentalists by not approving the pipeline in Canada for the time being. But if gas prices go up, which they've been going up, if they get $5, $6, I said $6 for the Californians because mm-hmm. in the East Coast we don't. We don't know what $4 gas is yet. Okay, yeah. So
really, but, what do you guys pay back there?
Yeah, we're in the threes still.
Wow,
upper threes.
I was $4.75. But go ahead.
So, but I think that if that will be an election issue, is they'll be able to say, look, you've symbolically, you didn't approve this, and that's leading to higher gas prices.
Well, they're blaming the turmoil in the Middle East and everything else, but don't you kind of get the impression that big oil can kind of throws a lot of weight around Washington and probably can, you know, make the prices do what they want to do, or am I being naive or just painting it with a big brush?
I'd rather not comment about that because I'm not sure of our business relationship with oil companies.
Okay.
But let's be honest here, because there's key swing states like Ohio and Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they have shale supplies, which President Obama is promoting as a cleaner alternative.
It costs a lot of money to produce the shale oil.
Right, but again, those are key swing states. Yeah. And so I think after the Republicans figure out who their candidate are, I think this topic is going to come more to the front.
But I mentioned last week, UCSD here in La Jolla has a fuel cell, the largest of any university, and they produce through cogeneration 85% of their own electricity. That just blows me away. If they can do that, a lot of businesses can do that. So, you know, let's get off the can here and do something. I mean, I bet you guys didn't know. Richard didn't know it.
No, I didn't know that. But we haven't talked about health care either,
mm-hmm.
and we're almost out of time. So health care policy, I know, well, Obamacare.
Okay.
Where's this thing going?
Well, I think the first thing is that the Supreme Court's going to make a decision either this summer or next summer, depending if they push it off.
I think they're going to push it off, by the way, but yeah, didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I think it comes – when we're talking about the individual mandate, what we're talking about is if it's seen as a question of the Commerce Clause and the constitutionality of it, I can't tell you today how that's going to turn out. I'm not a lawyer, but just from my 30,000 feet – but I think if it's determined, if it's on, based on whether or not the power of the government to tax, I think it's constitutional.
Mm-hmm.
So the question would be, how will they frame this? I think the administration, the Justice Department, said that the penalty for not getting your own health care is a tax, and that's what they're going to argue. And if that's the playing field you're on, it's not going anywhere.
From a consumer standpoint, though, I mean, premiums have gone up 150% since 2002. I mean, that can't continue indefinitely either. I mean, people are getting priced out of the market or taking very high deductibles and you know, throwing the dice that way.
And the reality is, I mean, that, you know, it's called the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's affordable for those who may not have been in it before, but for those who already had health care, we've seen consistent – it hasn't done anything to stem that growth and the prices. So, you know, what's the solution to that? Well, there's the political solution, the policy government solution of – well, in the debate, there was the public option to have the federal government compete with the private sector.
Or Medicare for everybody.
Medicare for everybody. But I think the part that – let's give – there's one part of this that might have a chance, and I'm not – It's changing the paradigm of how healthcare works, and that is instead of the fee for service scheme that we have now, moving towards a holistic outcome payment. Because if I, as a doctor, can say, okay, my goal is to get you from A to B, where B is healthy. Doesn't matter how I get there. If I get there a little cheaper, and I don't do XYZ tests because they're really not that necessary.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think people have a problem with that.
But I think they're getting a lot of prevention in this new act as well. I hear more about that.
Where certainly, there's more prevention in it than there's ever been in any other act.
Mm-hmm.
And
I
hear me. Andy, we want to thank you for solving all of our nation's problems.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, thank you for being with us today. We're winding it down here. But Andy Blocker from UBS in Washington, D.C., pleasure to have you here. Have a safe trip home. Richard, you have yourself a wonderful week. Thank you to Scott Love, our technical director, Dave Sniff, our programming genius, and Craig Blanke, our account executive. Thank you. Have a great week. Good night now.